Welcome back to Feminist Book Club, the podcast. We're not just about feminist books. We are here for social justice, literature, and media in all its forms. But we do that through an intersectional feminist lens. Thanks for being here. Let's get started.
Thank you for joining us on the Feminist Book Club podcast. We are here to talk about true crime. I'm Mariquita Guerrera.
And I'm Natalia Santana Pollard. And we are back again to discuss the whiteness of some form of media.
There's just a lot of whiteness in media.
I think so.
Yeah.
But so, anywho,
you know, we want to talk about true crime because, you know, if there's a lot of attention towards it, it's a salacious sort of genre and people have a lot of interest in it, but it's like deeply problematic for a lot of different reasons.
For sure. And it is semi-coincidental that the October theme for Feminist Book Club is true crime. We, Mariquita and I, had this idea, I think, even before the theme was announced. So we're just kind of riding the bandwagon. But I am going to give you guys a spoiler alert. We're not huge fans of the genre.
No. And you know, I think Renee made a comment on a different podcast episode about how we are not here to be critical of people that consume media from this genre. We're here instead to maybe say, you know, let's be contemplative about how we read these articles, how we read these books. When we watch these specials on Netflix or whatever, maybe we look at it with a questioning eye and examine in ourselves sort of what drives us to find these interests. And
correct. And there's also something to be said. I mean, I have lots of, I don't want to say problematic because that implies that liking true crime is problematic and it's not, but I have lots of tastes that you just kind of look at and you're like, really? That's the media that you're consuming. And there's no such thing as a perfect way to be an intersectional feminist. Mm-hmm. But what we aim to do with this particular episode is just hold up a light and a mirror and say, maybe the questions that we should be asking aren't so superficial. And maybe there is something deeper that we can work to address as we consume this media. So with that said, should we talk about first the demographics of true crime or
absolutely
the definition of true crime, or how should we get this going?
Well, I think, you know, if you talk a little bit about the demographics, I think that would be a good introduction.
Sure. So the demographics of true crime listening, they were very surprising to me as somebody who does not consume true crime media, but who kind of hears about it peripherally and tangentially. You know, I always expected it to be more of a male-dominated audience. However, that is so not true. Mm-hmm. So based on a 2018 study done by, I want to make sure that I give her flowers while she's here, Amanda Vickery, who's a social psychologist at the Illinois Wesleyan University. She found in 2018 or thereabouts that almost 73% of people who ingest true crime media are women. And she also found that men were more likely to read and review books about war. However, women were more likely to read and review true crime books. And the element that attracted female readers. And in this study, she doesn't talk about gender nonconforming or people who exist outside of the binary spectrum. So I don't know what those figures look like. And these were the most recent figures that I could pull. But anyways, compared to men, women liked reading about the psychological content of true crime stories where a killer was interviewed by an FBI profiler, or stories where you got to see the quote inner workings of a killer in some ways. Those tended to appeal more to women. And also women gravitated towards stories where the victim in the story was female. And she concluded in her study that women all seemed to like reading about survival, whether it was preventing or surviving a crime. And research shows that women fear crime more than men since they're more likely to be a victim of one. And her thinking was that this fear is leading women, even subconsciously, to be interested in true crime because, quote, they want to learn how to prevent it. And what surprised Vickery, and I thought was really interesting because I didn't expect this either, was neither female nor male subjects in her study. And I'll make sense of this at the end. But anyways, neither female or male subjects in her study were drawn to stories with explicitly emotional or sexual content. So if the story mentions a family who's really upset by the crime, or if the sexual content was really high in the story, or the victims were experienced certain types of abuse and or attack, it would turn the both male and female readers off, which is interesting to me because if men like reading more about war based on her findings, it would seem to me that they would be fine with emotional, well, not necessarily emotional, but like more graphic content, because what is war if not graphic? But anyways, so that's what she found in her study. And I just thought that before we really talked about it, we should understand who we're talking about. So we're talking about a mostly female audience, a majority female audience that is interested in learning about survival and kind of understanding how they could potentially escape similar situations if they were in those situations.
Do you think that's subconscious or conscious? Just your perspective.
No, yeah, it's interesting that you asked because I watch survival shows personally. Like the show I Shouldn't Be Alive is number one on my Amazon Prime viewing. And I watch it because I want to pretend that if I was ever in that situation, I would know how to get out of it. But for me, it's very conscious. It is explicitly the reason that I tell myself and my partner when he asks why I'm watching something terrible on TV, that is the explicit reason I give him. Like, I need to know tips. And I wonder, I think we would have to ask somebody who really listens to the genre and is really like into it, why they listen to it. Do they recognize that that's why they're listening to it? Do they see themselves within the victim or not? I don't know. Does that, and really, would that change how they relate to or experience the genre if they find a little bit of themselves in it? I don't know.
I think when I was younger, I really liked the true crime genre as it existed at that time and for my age group. I mean, I started off loving horror, you know, when I was a kid. Ugh. My mother read
Real
us-
life is so scary. Why do you need to make it scary?
It's interesting, you know, and I would love to do a different podcast episode on why we're attracted to horror, you know, but my mother read the original fairy tales to us when it's bedtime stories, you know, and so like the first time I saw
but like original fairy tales, like,
well,
the
she didn't read them in German. But well, she like, it was, you know, there was like the Cinderella story where the stepsisters like cut off their toes and their heels and they were bleeding into the glass slipper to try to like shove, and like the birds flew away with the pieces of their body. Like, yeah, we read those fairy tales as our bedtime story.
I wish you guys could see my horrified face right now, because I am boggled. The mind boggles at being read that as a fairy tale.
Well, and you know, it's, children are attracted to that. I mean, Neil Gaiman has made, you know, quite a career on but that principle alone. And the Graveyard Book won a Newbery, and like, it's, you know, it's, yeah. I don't think that we come to true crime as adults feeling like, oh, this is really something. I think there's maybe something more primal involved in it too. Not just mm-hmm. the things that we tell ourselves or the things that we're conscious of as to why we are consuming this, you know, material. I think there's something, you know, inside of us that is driven to seek out these stories. And part of it, you know, is there's probably a catharsis involved. There's probably some aspect of it that is, you know, like I wouldn't fall prey to that, or it wasn't, you know, that hasn't happened to me, thank God. Or, you know, if it did happen to me, I would, you know, you play out the story differently in your head. There might be an aspect of it that is creating that psychological separation between you and a victim, you know.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
You know, and so I think there, we would do ourselves and consumers of true crime a disservice by trying to like pretend it's just one really simple explanation, you know?
Well, yeah, for sure.
But I, you know, I did used to like, this is my tangent, but I did used to like true crime when I was younger. And I think that there was just a part of me that like, I know the feeling I got when I watched it, which was like almost like a giddiness, but like a sick feeling. Like it just didn't feel good. It felt like junk food kind of. And as I got older, I started to feel uncomfortable about it because it felt like a spectacle. Like these were people's lives that were lost, you know, people that had worth in this world, just in and of themselves, but also to the people who cared for them. And now it's like a, you know, a watch statistic or,
yeah,
or something that's like it's taken away the humanity of it and turned it into, yeah, into a spectacle. So that was the first thing.
Sorry, I didn't mean to jump over you, but it's interesting that you say that because one of the people who I talked to when kind of researching this article or researching this podcast, researching the podcast said that she is an avid consumer of true crime, right? Like she listens to it. But from a feminist perspective, she doesn't enjoy how it's always about humanizing the perpetrator of violence at the expense of the victim of the violence, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I wonder if we did it opposite, you know, would you still be a fan of the genre? Like if we heard more about the women whose lives were lost, would that change how you view it?
Well, that's a good segue because I think we do when it comes to white women.
What? I am shocked that we got here. Tell me more.
Thank you for walking into my trap. yeah.
Tell me what you found in your research.
So what I found is that we really put the spotlight on white women, specifically wealthy white women, thin white women, women that we perceive as being innocent. You know, blonde Ooh. Folks Ooh. That, yeah, folks that fit into the paradigm of Western beauty standard ideal, you know, and then there are layers under that. We pay less attention if the white woman was a sex worker, you know, we pay less attention if the white woman was in an abusive relationship or will then take the opportunity to blame her for her own.
Why didn't she just leave kind of deal?
Right, right. But we do focus. So when it's a white woman that is the victim of the crime, we focus on her in that respect. When it's a white woman that was a perpetrator of the crime, Jodi Arias, Casey Anthony, Amanda Knox, we focus on her as the perpetrator, not on the victim. So mm-hmm. we switch where that spotlight goes a lot of the time. I don't disagree that we do not humanize the victims a lot of the time. But I would say, big asterisk, we sort of turn them into stereotypes if they're white ladies.
That's what I was thinking of. You know, it. Whenever I think of true crime in my head, I always have it tied to Emmett Till's murder. Mm. So Emmett Till,
oh, my
if
heart.
You don't know the story, and I'm going to be very like 64,000 feet because I'm thinking about it in a 64,000 foot kind of way, but I very much urge you to look it up if you haven't looked it up and see the true miscarriage of justice that occurred. But Emmett Till was a little boy, little baby boy, who was lynched in Mississippi in 1955. after being accused of offending a white woman in her family's grocery store. He was a little boy and they lynched him, right?
Yeah.
And so the reason why I tie Emmett Till and true crime together typically as it relates to white women is because white women was, for a long time in our history, white women were something to be treasured, to be held apart, to be put on a pedestal while at the same time denigrating them. But that's kind of a separate story. But they needed to be protected from the world around them, put in a little bubble, and only brought down when it made sense to bring them down for cleaning, for procreating, for whatever. And this little boy paid for a crime with his life. And all anybody cared about at the time was this poor, innocent white woman. Now, in this case, she wasn't murdered, but I always hear these stories of true crime, you know, series, and I see them on Instagram or I see them talked about on TikTok. And the description of the woman who was harmed is always kind of the same when she's a white lady. You know, she walked into a room and smiled and lit up the whole room. And she was an angel on earth who just wanted to explore the wilderness. And she was so delicate, so this, so that. And by flattening out these victims, you know, are we really doing, even if you're looking at true crime from a truly educational perspective, are we really doing the right thing? Are we really giving them the full benefit of their humanity if we think that these women should be in a little plastic wrap?
We're requiring them to be the perfect victim. We're not allowing them to be full human beings, you know? And so we're not saying, we're basically, I think the, what's not being said is that if you have done anything that could be classified as scandalous or shameful, then your life isn't worth protecting and saving, you know? And so
I can't with that. Like that's, you know, so many Black women are murdered. So many missing. There are so many missing Indigenous women who are murdered. There are so many Black trans women and Brown trans women who are murdered. And it never matters. It never matters.
So I found this statistic, according to the Wyoming Task Force on Missing and Murdered Indigenous Persons, between the years of 2011 and 2020, so, you know, nine years, there were 710 Native American people that went missing in that state alone.
In right? that state, why doesn't Wyoming have like five people or something per that's square mile?
That's an average of 78.88888 people a year.
That's disgusting. That's disgusting. That's more than five people a month. And when do we hear about it? When do we hear about it? Off the backside of somebody like Gabby Petito's murder, we hear then about, oh my gosh, well, why isn't anybody paying attention to Indigenous women? Why isn't it? And then we get those statistics, but they're just as quickly swept back under the rug.
Yeah.
Or out of the media eye.
And so the same study found that white people were more likely to have an article written about them while they were missing. But Native people were more likely to have an article written for them after they were dead. And the articles that were written about them oftentimes were dispassionate. They use imagery, yeah, that didn't emphasize that they were whole people, you know, that they were important to their families. And sometimes used language that condemned them for their, you know, for their own disappearance or their own murder. And so, you know, that's another facet of when we're talking about how we're consuming true crime, you know, and why we're consuming true crime. Who are we leaving out of this conversation?
It reminds me of like you mentioned sex workers and things like that. Like, why do we require a semi-virginal woman to be a herald for all of us? It's so terrible. I can't.
Because patriarchy.
Yes. Speaking of that, you reminded me of something that I saw on TikTok by disability advocate Imani Barberin. God, I hope I'm saying that right. Barbarin? Anyways, my point is that she mentioned that all of the attention on the Gabby Petito case system is bad for white women as well, because then it's like something only happens after the woman has gone missing or has died. But when a woman goes to a police station and says, my husband's abusing mm-hmm. me, my partner's abusing me, whatever, the police tend to react like, that seems like a you problem, not a me problem, until something like goes further than that. Unless, and this is white on white crime, right? Because Brian Laundrie was white. But if the perpetrator is a person of color, or if the couple is an LGBTQ plus couple, then all of a sudden it may require more intervention. So like by focusing on and almost deifying women post missing and murdered status, we're not helping them when they're really alive. I thought that was a very interesting perspective.
That's one of the reasons that I've read that people, especially women, do like true crime, is because it feels like here's an example of someone listening to the story being told.
But don't they all die in the end?
Not all of them, but like I would say probably 99%. I'm just saying we can't talk in absolutes. That's all I'm saying.
No. That's fair. That is totally fair. And I feel like I should be very clear, and maybe we should have topped the segment with this, but I am biased because I do not like scary things.
I think we did sort of top the segment with that when you responded to my story about how I read fairy tales.
Oh God, I don't like scary things. I have a job where I see the worst happen to people in terms of disasters and happen to cities and all of this stuff. And I cannot emotionally consume anything reminds me that it's real bad out there. So I'm like, yes, talk to me about science and plants and cooking. I am all for that. But like, you know, you hear that meme where it's like what women are really listening to when they're doing any activity. And it's like her ears were cut off. Her head was cut off. Her tongue was cut out. Her eyes were scooped out. Like I just, gives me the willies.
Yeah. That's okay. That's okay.
Is it though?
It is absolutely okay. It is. Because we're not here to criticize or impugn people that like true crime or people that don't like it. We're just here to have a conversation about what does it mean to be a consumer of true crime? And what does it mean to be an ethical consumer of true crime? And,
ever ethical consumption of true crime?
Oh boy. What do you think?
I think that the way that true crime is structured now, where to your point, it's a little bit dispassionate. It's flattening people. It's putting them into bite-sized morsels that are easy for like a sound clip or whatever. I don't think that consumption of true crime can be ethical in the way that it is now. However, I think that if you imbue your segment, your podcast, your story with the political context, with the institutional context, with the systemic context, with all of the things that got us to this place, right? All of the ways in which we fail women, in which we fail ourselves by not having adequate systems, in which we do political brinkmanship, in which we do all of these things, right? And we ask ourselves, how can we make this our last true crime story? Because we've solved these problems, then I think it can be ethically consumed. I just don't think that that's possible in this kind of world right now.
Yeah. What if we ask ourselves, can we use this coverage to shine light on the inequities in coverage in other populations and get some attention on the missing individuals and other groups?
But how do we do that? How practically do people do that without speaking over those communities?
Yeah. So before we started recording this, you and I talked a little bit about how Gabby Petito's father, and I am very sorry if I'm mispronouncing the surname here, because I have not been listening to really coverage on this at all, just in general. And because we were going to be recording this, and so I wanted to have a more of a blank slate. But her father, Joseph, has in a press event expressed appreciation for the spotlight that was shown on Gabby's case, but asked that the media do more work to cover the cases of other people that are missing, people of color, the missing and murdered Indigenous women, trans people. And in 2011, the Human Rights Commission has found that there has been acts of violence, fatal violence against 37 trans people in 2021 already. Last year was the highest ever in their recording. And I think there were 44. And we're going to link to this article in the show notes. I would encourage people to read it. Please, please, please read it. There is a short bio on every person whose life was lost, information about their name, you know, and who they were and what they liked. You know, please, let's humanize these people. But Joseph Petito is starting a foundation called the Gabby Petito Foundation. And we could have a whole conversation about laws named after white ladies who have lost
the
their
whiteness
lives.
Of law naming. That's yeah. The next segment that we do.
Yeah. but it's going to be, the foundation is going to be working to try to help uplift these other organizations who are doing the work to find missing people in different demographics that aren't always covered.
And I think that if he can do that by using his privilege as a white man, as a cis white man, and not take credit for,
yeah,
speak over, or somehow Christopher Columbus the whole situation.
TBD.
Then, yeah, exactly, TBD. But I am a little cynical in how I've seen like the Sean Kings of the world operate. Where the road to hell is paved with good intentions. You know, you start with, I want to help uplift voices. And then you go to, I'm going to talk over these voices, to, I'm the center of attention. The only voice you should be listening to is me. And that's just exhausting.
For so sure. Exhausting. And I'm not here to champion that foundation. I am only.
No, but that's a really good point. And I like it. I think the thing that I like the most is that he's acknowledging that there are other people who have already been doing this work for a really long time. And he's just there, that foundation's there to uplift their voices and help out in whatever way he can. And that's a real bro thing to do. Here's hoping he just keeps on keeping on.
Yeah. Yeah. Fingers crossed. It's about all I can do. But like on an individual level, you know, we as individuals can look for organizations in our area that are doing this work.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And like, it's fine and dandy to donate to larger nationwide organizations. And nobody's saying that that's wrong. And it's something that Feminist Book Club has done before with our 5%, you know, charitable donations. However, there is so much good work being done by people who are truly in the community, who truly know what's happening in your local area, who have that political, that systemic, that individual context, that if you gave them money, it would shoot them to the moon and help them really, you know, do good work. So I live in Atlanta. There will be organizations that I'm definitely looking into in Atlanta that I, you know, will help with my dollars, because cash is the best gift you can give anyone. Mm-hmm. And I'll die on that hill. And then somebody will make a true crime podcast about, no, they won't. I'm brown. I don't know what I'm thinking.
Nice try.
But I think that in a case like this, you definitely have to be, I think, focused on the local, because that's going to be the most contextually appropriate and will help real people in the area around you.
Yeah. Yeah. I really hope that there is a little bit of a sea change. I've seen a lot more coverage from a lot of mainstream news sources about, is it appropriate the way we're reporting on true crime you know, since the Gabby Petito thing. And I think it's great to start with that question, but to have a full conversation around it is what's really needed. And to change some of our behaviors and our thought patterns around it is what's really needed. You know, I think even
for sure,
even Newsmax said that there was maybe too much coverage.
Stop it right now.
On white ladies. Yeah. No, what? But yeah. And then someone immediately countered it and said, you know, stop making it about skin race. Color and whatever. But, yeah. You know, I mean, if we're hitting this level of super saturation with this, where we're starting to go like, okay, no, maybe there is like something like weird about this. Like maybe there are people being left out of this conversation. If we're starting to have those thoughts on a national level, my hope is that we can maybe change the lens a little bit, you know? And so that way folks that really do want to, you know, read true crime or listen to true crime or watch it, can get the catharsis that they need out of it, can feel the safety that they need out of it, but can honor the people, whose lives were lost, who can humanize them from like an entire, you know, full spectrum of like flawed humanity, you know?
Yep. You don't have to be the perfect Instagram influencer to matter.
No, you can be a impoverished person. You can be a brown or a black person. You can be a trans or non-binary person. You can be a sex worker. You could be someone with a drug addiction, someone in an abusive relationship. And you still matter because you're a person and you still matter.
This is shocking. So check out the show notes. We'll definitely drop some links to the stories that we read. And let us know your thoughts. You know, are we off the mark? Do you feel like you ethically consume true crime? Have you even thought about how or why you consume true crime media? Is it a survival thing? We want to know. We want to hear from you. You can reach me on Twitter at @NatSandPaul. Or catch me tweeting from the Feminist Book Club brand handle, which I'm sure Renee regrets giving me access to every day, at FMNST Book Club. And you can also reach me on Instagram. I'm at Stitchcraft in Wizardry. And right now I'm going through a big knitting phase. So you guys are going to likely see a lot of that interspersed with my book commentary. But yeah, Mariquita.
Well, I am only on Instagram and only sporadically. Sorry.
It's because you had a full human being.
I had a baby.
I'm so excited.
Did. And so now I'm even less on Instagram. And there will never be pictures of my baby on Instagram. Just.
I do not post.
I know you know.
Nope. Of my children on either. On any public social media platform, or no. That is not my business. That is their business.
Exactly. She's in charge of her digital footprint and she is not of an age of consent where, you know, she can understand that. So it's not going to be on there, but you can find me on Instagram and all my books and all the things I take pictures of when I run at @OH_MURRAY. That's at @O_Murray.
Well, thanks for listening with
us. Thanks for joining us.
We will see you on the next page and maybe not as a subject of a true crime podcast.
Oh, and also if you are into true crime, maybe check out the Feminist Book Club True Crime
October box. Yes,
October.
Definitely. I have conflicted feelings about the book, but boy, howdy, am I going to eat that popcorn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we can talk about it. We can talk about it.
Anyways,
thanks, friends.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode of Feminist Book Club, the podcast. Want to be part of the club? Here's how you can join us. Obviously, subscribe to our podcast and leave a rating and review for brownie points. Follow along on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, Pinterest, and TikTok. All of those links are in the show notes. Sign up for our newsletter to be the first to know what our next monthly book pick is. And check out our award-winning monthly book subscription service. Oprah Magazine named it one of their favorite book boxes, and Shonda Rhimes called us one of her favorite subscription boxes in general. There are multiple membership levels for any budget, and it's an excellent way to support the show and the voices you heard today. See you in the club.
A well-read woman is a dangerous creature.